Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and on today's First Coast Connect, how did you sleep last night? Well, if you live in a high-crime neighborhood, chances are not great. We're talking to people who live with and diagnose the roots of chronic insomnia. Later in the program, 100 years after Jacksonville was America's first Hollywood, the city is looking to get back into show business. But first, the sound of gunfire is the unfortunate soundtrack of many First Coast neighborhoods. It's an indicator of a problem, but it can also create one. To talk about the impact of crime on communities' sleep patterns, we're joined by Dr. Alexis Rojas. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Dana Miller, owner of the Man Cave Barbershop on A. Philip Randolph Boulevard. Hey, Dana.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Probably have you scooch a little closer to the mic there. And Jasmine Monroe, reporter and anchor with First Coast News. Welcome back, Jasmine.
Hey, good morning, Ann.
So, Jasmine, you recently did a deep dive into this story for First Coast News, and you looked at how crime, including something like gunfire, has an impact long after shots are fired. Tell us what you learned.
So basically, it was something that was so interesting. When I first moved here to Jacksonville, a lot of people just talked about how Duval County is such a big area and how, you know, sleeping can be hindered by gun violence, the sound of police sirens, the sound of firefighters arguing, shootings, just so much. Even if you turn on the news today, our top story was a shooting in the area. So my interest was, you know, how are people sleeping in these areas? So I actually looked up the story, and it was Northwestern University who did a study on the importance of sleep and how it can hinder anything that you do. How you live your life, how you wake up, how the decisions that you choose to as well. And it all went off of basically a fresh night's sleep, you know, with nothing happening, and then a night of sleep of just crime. And the studies just show that people who live in high crime areas suffer from sleep insomnia. And that was just horrific. I spoke to a woman, her name is Robin Clemens, and she told me that she took two different medications and a melatonin in order to go to sleep, and she still hasn't had a good night's rest. She lost her husband. She lost her brother-in-law. She lost her son, all to gun violence. And, you know, it's really hard to just wrap your mind around how you can get a good night's sleep after losing three people so close to you. And when we told her this news, she just realized that she is a part of the statistic.
And so, Dr. Rojas, what do we know about, just generally speaking, about why sleep, quality sleep, is an important thing for people to have in the first place?
So I just want to start by thanking you, Jasmine, for bringing this topic to everyone's attention. And I'll start by saying there is probably no more critical and no more important of a thing than a good night's sleep. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, as we go through. But what happens when we have these little micro experiences that are traumatic to each one of us, which is experienced differently based on who you are, based on your makeup, based on your environment. And those, as they compound, impact many of our body functions, many of our experiences. And one of the biggest is sleep. And so I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about what that does long term. But it impacts you if you think about it from head to toe, from every function in your body.
And so sleep has its place in terms of getting you well rested, but it does, as you say, have other connections to our health. And some of those are mental health.
Absolutely. So we see a lot of patients at UF Health, where I work, and a lot of those patients come in with major traumatic experiences, bad car accidents, attacks, assaults, etc. And many of those patients, sadly, this is not their first experience. And so we see chronic repeated nightmares. We see delayed initiation of sleep. So that is how long it takes you to fall asleep at night. And that's actually a lot of what you talked about, Jasmine, in your article. We see frequent disruptions in your sleep pattern. We also see things like regression in young kids. And so whenever there's been a traumatic event that happens or repeated chronic violence, we may see things like regression, where they start wetting the bed again or they start having tantrums. So it impacts behavior, psychiatric health, et cetera.
Dana, you own a business right around the corner from here on A. Philip Randolph.
Yes, I do.
Man Cave.
Yes, Man Cave Barbershop.
Barbershop. Yes. It's on the east side. You've had personally several experiences with loss and trauma.
Yes, I have. My brother, he was murdered in 1992. And the trauma of having him being murdered, I still feel the effect of it today. Some people say you'll get over it. Time heals all wounds. not a murder, not knowing someone's life was taken, and you will suffer insomnia, sleep pattern dysfunction because of a murder or a crime that was committed in the community. And as the doctor and my sister was speaking of, it's that it affects your livelihood, and it affects the way you treat people, your attitude, the way you look at life, the lack of hope. And it's just a pattern that affecting a lot of families and friends in the community, especially the community that I service.
And you mentioned your brother, but there have been more recently than even that 1992 murder.
Yes, yes. It's sad to say, just lost a young client of mine a few months ago. Let's say in the past 10 to 13 years since I've been back out east, I've seen or witnessed a nephew murdered. Some of my clients, I'm talking about young boys in their teens, and some in their older. And a young guy, he was a good friend of mine. He was murdered about December 1st of last year. Just came from a high school basketball game, standing out on the block with his friends, and he was by himself, and the car just drove up and shot him and killed him right there in the neighborhood. And just think, every day, these kids are hearing these sirens. They're hearing about death on the streets. They're seeing the blood in the streets. And it's really a trauma, and it's hard to sleep at night because you don't know where a bullet fly through your window, or you walk out the house and catch a bullet. It's very sad. It's very sad.
Your line of work, I mean, you're a barber, obviously, but you, in addition to that, do work that exposes you to a different kind of trauma on a regular basis. Tell us about the work that you do in preparing people who've been killed.
Well, I've done a documentary on my life with my brother being murdered, and I was shot myself 10 times. In the past, and I'm able to relate with the victims or the victim's family member, or the young brothers, the young guys that come in my barbershop to get their hair cut, or older guys, and I know what they're going through. So I'm able to talk with them and try to give them some type of relief or some type of comfort, knowing that I've been through it, and just have to stay prayed up because it's really a tragic and it's really a problem in our community, and it's hard. It's hard. Sometimes I have to act like I'm their father, the psychologist, a psychiatrist, or someone just a mentor. I have to play all these roles being the community barber. And I have to know how to separate the two when I go home, not to take that trauma home with me. So just like we said, I lived in that type of environment, a community. But I stay in the community I stay in now. It's a real nice community. I go home, I sleep well at night, and it does affect your life daily.
It makes a difference.
It does. It really does.
You also work with a funeral home.
Yes, I do.
Talk about the work that you do there, because that's another exposure that most people wouldn't think about.
Oh. When I think about, I work for QL Douglas Funeral Home, and what I do is I go in and I repair the damage that was done to the gunshot victim. They may have patches of hair taken out where it was shot in the head, and I'll go in and reconstruct that where you won't even tell that they've been shot. But the sad thing is, it's the age of the young guys that are coming in those funeral homes, in the back of that funeral home. 16-year-olds. You see a young guy, just heard him the night before on the news, and my boss, he'll call me to the funeral home and say, Dana, I have another client for you. And just to think, it's that young guy just saw the news that was murdered. It affects you. You have to put on tough skin to go back there to be able to do that type of work. So what I do is I go back there and I may talk to him. I just say, oh man, what happened? What happened? You're young, you're a handsome young fella. Oh man. And my heart goes out to their family. But now I have to psych myself out. I see so much of it, and how I do that is I look at them as mannequins, as a stiff dummy and not a person. And that's the only way I'm able to get through the trauma of not allowing it to really affect me and my sleep pattern. I used to go home after I leave the funeral home, and it'd take me like a couple of days to really get it out of my system. And have to have the lights on at home to go to sleep comfortable. But I'm doing well now.
Jasmine, Dana has obviously been through an extraordinary amount of, you know, traumatic experiences in his life. But we do know, and you've reported, that every one of these incidents has a ripple effect. Every time that there is a shooting, fatal or not, there's people impacted. It could just be the sound of the gunshot, or it could be, you know, they know the person that was injured, or, you know, there's children, there's parents, there's classmates.
I think the thing, I like, you have me emotional because just even hearing the passion in your voice, to know that you do care about these young men. And I just even to think to just go back for just a second, how therapeutic being at a barbershop is and being at a hair salon is. It's so much therapy that happens there, because a lot of those guys do come into those places and they don't have a father. They don't have an uncle, or they lost their uncle, or they lost their father or their brother. And you are pretty much all they have.
Yeah.
For that day. So even the slightest word, you know, speaking to the experts, they said the slightest word of be safe out there. Have a good day. Have a great day.
I love you.
Yeah, I love you. These kids don't even hear these words. And, you know, it just breaks my heart even, you know, comparing this city to Cleveland. It's such a tough city. And these kids are really going through something that I don't think anyone has ever experienced even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, because we're dealing with social media. So this stuff doesn't, it used to just be in the classroom and you can go home and you can talk to your mom or dad and, you know, you don't have to worry about it. You play basketball and you move on about your day. But, you know, this stuff follows you. This stuff sticks with you. And I don't know about you, being on social media sometimes is draining. You know, it takes a toll out of you. So even speaking with the experts, they say things like, you know, changing your outcome, the colors, and even looking inside of First Coast Connect, the colors in here just brighten up your day, because sometimes these kids don't have a meal to eat. And it goes back to education, too. You know, these teachers are expecting these kids to pass a test when they just lost their brother the day before. I was out covering a story. A father lifted up yellow tape so a daughter can get on the bus to go to school. I mean, what is the connection to that? You know, how do you really tell a child that they could be the president of the United States when this is what they have to go to in order to get to school?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the health impacts of people living in high crime communities and disordered sleep. You can join the conversation on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. We have a call from Charles. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Good morning, folks. I moved into my house back in 1973, so it's been 50 years, and I've watched my sleepy little West Side Bird Sanctuary community devolve into constant gunshots every night. And the worst of it was about 4 years ago, I witnessed a murder out in front of my house. I saw a man get gunned down, and I did my civic duty and called the police, and then wound up being the witness at the man's murder trial, and so I was pretty stressed out by that. So long story short, I got diagnosed with PTSD and anxiety on top of everything else from the VA, so I never get more than a few hours of sleep at night, because it's either gunshots or firecrackers, and I am in such a state of hypervigilance all the time that, you know, I'm ready to jump out of my skin when I hear this, you know, a gunshot or a fireworks go off. So, yes, there is an effect, you know.
Thank you, Charles. Dr. Rojas.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, and thank you, Dana, for sharing your experience, too. And that is a beautiful example of what happens to the nervous system when we have repeated exposure to trauma. Sometimes it's one adverse event. Sometimes, for most of us, it's multiple, chronic, repeated. So it's the hypervigilance he reported. It's the feeling that's kind of like you're going to jump out of your skin. It's the upset stomach, the GI distress. It's the intrusive thoughts. And Dana shared with us he had to go home and turn the lights on, because I'm assuming there were these constant repeated thoughts of, what could this child's life have been like? What would have his future looked like? You know, could this be me? Could this be my child? And those type of thoughts are really kind of the landmark of when we talk about PTSD and repeated chronic trauma. So Charles gave us a wonderful example of the hypervigilance, but there are many, many more symptoms that can come with that.
What do we know about the accumulation of experiences?
That is such a good question. You know, we conceptualize it differently. So kind of all of us can agree that repeated trauma is going to have repeated lasting effects. But I would say one of the primary things that we do know is that those effects can last for a very long time. And we do know that psychotherapy is one of the most effective strategies to manage that. Unfortunately, there is not a magic pill for trauma treatment. So finding a good quality psychotherapist, a good quality therapist who has real life experience working with patients with repeated trauma is probably going to be your best treatment route.
We've got a call from Biko in Jacksonville. Good morning, Biko. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Anna. Thank you for allowing me to come in and just share my experience. I'm sure you know a little, you know, background about my experiences as a victim of gun violence. So I was shot over there on the east side when I was 17. Then that following year, I got shot again. And so, you know, that effect on me sleeping, you know, is something that I struggled with for a really long time. And, you know, it affected my view of how I see my neighborhood. It affected how I connected with my family. And for a long time, I wasn't comfortable walking in the street without me constantly always looking behind my back and making sure that nobody, you know, come in and attack me. But, you know, I didn't get some help until after I started working for Care of Violence, you know, for the Care of Violence out there on the east side. So I had, you know, I had a participant who was a victim of gun violence as well, too. So I was able to relate to them and share my experience of how I healed through the trauma of being a gun violence victim. And for a long time, you know, I struggled with that. And once I started, you know, started the process of healing, and one of the critical things that really helped me get through was just having a therapist. I started taking therapy while I was in the program, and it helped me tremendously, what I'm telling you right now, and how much I have healed over that. Now my sleep are getting a lot better. During my experience working with Care of Violence, you know, I had one of my participants while I was leaving work. I ended up stopping right there off A Street, you know, trying to see what was going on. I ended up to be one of my participants that was shot and killed. And that kind of triggered back my experience. And I kind of had to, you know, try to find a way to deal with it with the experience that I didn't have with the therapy. And, like, you know, even to right now, I still kind of, you know, still having carrying that trauma, having to see him die. It was just heartbreaking for me. And for a few months while I was, you know, still working for Care of Violence, I couldn't focus on my work, you know, and it really took me under until I had to kind of, you know, use some of that skill that my therapies taught me to kind of get recover back again.
Yeah, it's a constant road and a constant effort. Biko, thank you. Thanks for the work you do in the community as well. Yeah, go ahead, Dana. Yeah,
I'd like to speak on what Biko was saying because I was shot, and being a gunshot victim, right now, if I hear a popping sound, I'm always jumping. I'm always jittery. It scares me. A carbide fire. It reminds me of the time I got shot. So, and I never had therapy. It's just something I've been dealing with for the past 30 years. And just seeing the trauma of what's going on in these communities. And the thing about it is all over Jacksonville now. It's not just one particular community anymore because two young teenagers was killed the other night, 16-year-olds. And it was in a nice neighborhood. And
Island
it just,
Point, I think.
Yeah, yes, it was, yeah. And it's just happening everywhere. And I believe every family in Jacksonville and around the country have someone they know that has been a victim of gun violence. So we're all in this together.
We have a message from Brooks on Facebook. He wanted to thank you, Dana. He says, thanks for sharing your deeply personal story. We do know some data in terms of what is captured by the system known as ShotSpotter in this city. Mm-hmm. So that is a you know, a policing device that's used to pick up gunshots and allows police to respond to a gunshot if it hasn't, if it isn't phoned in 911. We know that those are down this year, but they're looking at about 1,300 to 1,700 alerts every year. And those are only in high crime neighborhoods. So those are not all over the city. So there really is, as you're saying, Dana, an opportunity, not a great one, but an opportunity to very often be hearing those triggers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, Dana, what was the reason why you chose not to, to go to therapy? Because I feel like oftentimes there is this viewpoint, especially with Black men, that going to therapy makes you weak, or it's, you know, it's just a stigma.
Well, me, it was never offered to me.
Yeah.
I have no problem with going to therapy, but it's not offered to my community like that. No one's coming in saying we have this workshop or we have this team of doctors that you could come and talk to. And then a lot of guys in my community, they don't trust. Mm-hmm. They don't trust anybody. They try to hold on to their masculinity, their manhood, thinking if I talk about that, I show weakness, you know, I can't survive this. So we're all in survival mode, and it's sad.
And if I might, Dana, you know, one of the big things I was hoping to address today was how challenging access to care can be. And so when we talk about making sure that everyone can get equal opportunity and access to see high quality trained psychologist or therapist to get the treatment they need, that can be very difficult. So we do need to be communicating about that. We do need to be talking about that. And there are efforts to increase access. There are a lot of efforts going on. So I would just encourage anybody who is hoping to get any kind of access to treatment to be, try your best to be vulnerable and to reach out and to people like you who are working in the communities, our barbers, our family-owned coffee shops, the people in the community, and you all can kind of be beakers to get these folks connected to. And so I'd love to talk off-air, Dana, about
I would love to.
Yeah, maybe some ways we can partner together.
Exactly.
I think that very often there's services available for someone who's a direct victim of crime, but, you know, as we're discussing, there's so many people that can be impacted by a crime, and those kinds of counseling services typically aren't available to people who are peripherally connected.
So I know one of my colleagues was able to run a violence prevention program many years ago through our institution, and it was greatly successful, but contingent, like most programs, are grant funding and things like that. And so we hope to continue those efforts, because I couldn't agree with you more. Secondary or tertiary trauma, just being secondarily exposed to these things, increases your risk greatly to develop something like moral injury and eventually PTSD. Yes.
So there has been some research on this in terms of the really manifold impacts of being a crime victim or knowing someone, being close to someone who's a crime victim, especially for children. There was a recent analysis done that found that, first of all, that surviving a gunshot wound as a child can really turn them into lifelong patients, was the phrase that was used, so that the recovery is not a foregone conclusion. The costs are enormous, that the year after an injury, that medical costs for a child that's been shot increases by an average of $35,000. That's ER visits, home health care, hospitalizations. But also, you know, those are people who survive, but those costs, you know, trail them and their families. And we know that financial strain can also be, you know, cause its own fallout.
Well, I'll add, this is a beautiful example of why it's so important that large health institutions have psychologists on staff in their trauma units, in their trauma teams. And that's a part of what, you know, our program was the first to do it many, many decades ago. And every patient that comes in under an acute trauma that is hospitalized and admitted, we are often consulted, and we come in and we're able to begin the trauma treatment, Dana, that you and I kind of just quickly talked about right there. And now, of course, in the beginning, we're managing acute symptoms, but we can also help facilitate connection to care when they transition out. And so getting ahead of it early and making sure these pediatric patients especially are connected to services right after the initial event is very important.
And Jet, you know, go ahead, Dana.
And you know what's so amazing? There are a lot of guys that want help, and they're seeking someone to talk to. That's why they flood my barbershop,
yeah,
talking with me because of my experience. And to have an organization to come in and that we can come together and offer these services, that's something that my partners and I, business partners and I on the East Side Quarter, out East, we've been trying to put together. And being able to partner with you, Doctor, it would be tremendously a blessing.
It's interesting, Dana, when I was preparing for this program, I was talking to a local crime, you know, he's a community advocate who mm-hmm. focuses on crime. And he said he knew a lot of people who were willing to discuss an incident, a shooting or a killing, but they didn't want to discuss the personal impacts like sleeplessness.
Yes.
And I think that goes to what Jasmine was saying about there being, it's sort of stigmatized to talk about the emotional impacts of some traumatic events.
Yeah, because they have an image to uphold. Mm-hmm. And when they're talking about sleeping patterns and talking about their personal space, make them look weak. That's what they think. But to me, you have to be vulnerable. You have to allow yourself to feel your emotions. That's the only way you can heal. That's how I was able to heal. I had to completely break down. And when I was able to break down by the grace of God, I was able to build back up. That's why I'm where I am now in life, because I was able to look at that incident and try to learn from every experience that I have. And being able to give of myself to help my community. And I see it every day. Guys coming in my barbershop talk about their marriage, talk about lost friends, and they're going through trauma every single day, and there's no help. So I want to open up my barbershop to be able to help these guys. And I'm looking forward to working with you, Doctor, partnering with you on this.
I think it's also, I was going to also add that sometimes it gets overwhelming, because I know that specific programs, Big Brothers and Big Sisters, is what I work with, the LeBron James Family Foundation. Sometimes often you hear these stories and you realize this is too much for me to handle, mm-hmm. and you don't have that mm-hmm. person to go to. So I do suggest you, when you do take advantage of these opportunities, to when it gets too heavy for you, to reach out for those experts, because sometimes you can't steer somebody down the wrong way or lead someone to that even, you know, terrible advice to get them in a situation. Help is always out there. And, you know, if anyone is listening out there, help is always out there. You just have to ask for it. You have to put your pride aside. And also doing this story, what I learned how to do, even for myself, you know, I'm not living in an area full of crime. But
you're exposed to it.
But
a lot.
I'm exposed to it because I work in this industry, and I'm very passionate about gun violence. When it comes to gun violence in specific areas, I stand with, victims when it comes to this, because, you know, telling your son or, you know, your daughter that your father or your mother died in an accident that you can't even explain yourself or go through yourself, that's heavy. But what I did learn is how to compartmentalize things, and how to put things, you know, after, like you said, like I have to leave work and I have to put that there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't take that home.
That's right.
You know, and they also mentioned the music that we listen to,
yes.
The food that we eat. The people that you hang around, too much of something is never good, right? We all know that. But it was compartmentalizing that helped save me, I would say.
And I think you made a great point that it's therapeutic in nature just to share, just to have community. But mm-hmm. there is a point where there are clinical needs that need to be met. And we do have to be very careful there, because we as human beings want to be able to predict the future, but we often can't. So we need to be very careful about what kind of advice or information we're sharing. And I would always encourage to just share with somebody, hey, this could be really helpful. Maybe you should call this phone number. This could be something that could change your life, because it's not just the sleep that's impacted. It's your nervous system arousal. It's your appetite. It's your irritability. It's your relationship with others. This is a spiral. And if we don't get ahead of it early, then we could see long-term impacts to all of those areas of life.
I want to take a call from Felita. Good morning, Felita. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. I was calling just to say thank you for this segment this morning. Thank you so much.
Felita, you've had some experience with crime. We've spoken in the past. How has it impacted your ability to sleep and that kind of basic level function?
Well, me being a survivor of gun violence, being shot 13 times and left for dead, and actually being shot by someone from my community. I also grew up on the east side of Jacksonville, and I was shot by someone I knew and had known all my life. When I got shot, being that at that particular moment, he was still on the run, it was hard for me to do anything. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't even come home after I was in the hospital for over a month. I had to have an officer there with me every day, every minute of the day, because he was still on the run. And I went to my mom's house when I got out of the hospital because I was scared. I couldn't sleep. I really didn't have an appetite, and this went on for months. And so it is, it is very traumatizing. And then just to not have counseling. This happened to me exactly 20 years ago, and I just got counseling like in the last two years.
Thanks, Felita. And I am glad that you are getting some counseling. We have an email from Shannon. She says, I have a friend who was a teacher at a Title I school, and she said she had a full nap corner for kids because they would come in and obviously not have slept at all.
Wow.
Isn't that sad? So it's kids coming to school with no sleep because of the neighborhood they live in. So,
and we know that sleep disruption early in life has major impacts on your overall physical health. You know, we've all heard of ACEs, of course, and these are traumatic experiences that we kind of tally up, things that we've experienced that cause us to have greater risk for either later on health conditions or psychiatric conditions. And I think we could all agree that sleep is one of those primary factors.
And one of the experts that I also spoke to, too, they described sleep as breathing, as eating. Sometimes people just go without sleep and think that's okay. Is that okay?
No, that is not okay. And if that's the case, they certainly should come in and see a professional immediately. And I kind of laugh and say that lightly, but I mean that very seriously. The mechanism of sleep has many functions, and we call it rest and recovery for a reason, because it's able to help us process some of those traumas, those micro traumas we experience every day. It helps us to just kind of flush, and it helps us to be prepared moving forward for the future.
It's an important topic, and I thank you all for coming in and talking about it today, and Dana, especially for sharing your stories and your personal experiences.
Thank you for having me.
Dana Miller, Jasmine Monroe, and Dr. Alexis Rojas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right, up next, city officials hope a slate of new film incentives makes Jacksonville ready for its close-up. Welcome back. The city of Jacksonville will begin screen testing a package of new incentives designed to lure Hollywood back to the First Coast. To talk about what those financial incentives look like and what they could mean, I'm joined by Todd Rubin, film commissioner for the city of Jacksonville. Hi, Todd.
Good morning, Ann.
And Sharon Cobb, a local screenwriter
and
longtime filmmaker. Nice to have you. So, Todd, what is the job of the film commissioner, and how is that going to maybe change with these new incentives?
Well, the job of the film office is to market the city as far as a wonderful destination for production. We promote our local excellent workforce, the working crew, the locations. We facilitate permitting, of which there's no charge for that. We expedite and process permits on City of Jacksonville locations, whether it be city parks, city streets, buildings that are occupied or unoccupied by the city, but then connect the dots to the local workforce and the businesses and the industry. We have a wonderful website, filmjax.com.
I saw that, and there's some buildings on there that I was surprised. Like, there's the state attorney's office building. I wonder, is everybody in those buildings, like, okay with the idea of being the site of a potential film?
So, you know, for instance, there was a production that filmed in the courthouse, the former courthouse building, and that was on Saturday and Sunday. So the film office, definitely, we get involved with speaking, coordinating the logistics and speaking with the decision makers who manage those different buildings and work on days or nights when they're not being utilized. The city council chambers was used for filming of the HBO movie Recount.
Huh. Sharon, you're a professional screenwriter. You've sold a dozen projects to Hollywood. When you're pitching, does the location ever enter into it? Do you have sort of a fixed idea of where you want it to be staged, or is that more of an after
Sometimes
thought?
We can. It depends on the production and depends on the pitching, because there are certain productions that will be very open to locations. And, you know, we say we're thinking of Florida or Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then the whole production idea of budget comes up. And that has to do with incentives. And I think Todd's got some really, I'm so happy to see some incentives for this, our city now coming up.
Because that makes a big difference.
An incredible difference. It makes all the difference, yes.
And so these incentives are basically, if you employ local people, if you buy local, you'll be able to get a significant rebate.
Yes. And it puts us back in competition, not only with other Florida cities that do have such programs, but other cities and other areas. I mean, we're back in competition, and it's attracting your larger budgeted productions, whether it be feature films, television, which is one program, and another program is for larger budget commercial productions. And lastly, we're offering a fostering filmmaker grant program.
You say back in competition. When did we fall out of competition?
Well, I think incentives, no question about it.
When did that end?
Well, the incentives, there's incentives as far as, the state of Florida had,
sure,
had a program.
And that ended in the 90s, right?
Well, actually, Don Davis, back when he was a legislator, probably in 2010, to last about 2016. So it raced basically 2016, the state program sunsetted. And that's when you started seeing projects being lured up into Georgia because of their incentive program.
So there is also a history, though, Sharon, of the city, you know, back in the early 1900s was the Hollywood of the South. I mean, it was competing with Los Angeles as a warm weather destination
yes.
for film, and it really was very successful for a time.
Yes, it was. It was. And that started, I think Todd knows all the details on the dates, but that started in the early 1900s. And Norman Studios, and if you haven't visited Norman Studios, it's actually restored and it has a museum, which is really awesome, over on Arlington Road in Arlington. And that is a fantastic example of what was actually going on at that time in Jacksonville. It's a shame that the whole production, studios and everybody fled Jacksonville to go to that little place called Hollywood.
The Norman Studios is really the last relic of the heyday of filmmaking. That was a black film production company.
Richard Norman, a white man, actually hired black actors, and they played amazingly heroic roles. And he successfully, back then there were theaters that were segregated, but he did a wonderful, wonderful job in producing these. And we're so thankful that the city of Jacksonville's park system has the Norman Studios under its fold, as well as the Norman Studios Board of Directors. It has its own 501c3, and they oversee the day-to-day operations as well.
So just briefly, if people want to get information about this new incentive program,
I encourage everybody to look at filmjax.com, go to the website and click the incentive tab, and the programs are all there, plus so much more.
Todd Rubin, Sharon Cobb, I wish we had more time to talk. Thank you so much for being
Thank
here.
You,
we really
Anne.
Appreciate it. Up next, some music appreciation with Musical Milestones and Mahler. And we're back. It's the 75th season for the Jacksonville Symphony. It's also the 10-year anniversary for music director and conductor Courtney Lewis. And I am here with Courtney Lewis. Congratulations. This is a big season coming up for you.
Thank you, and we're really excited about it. Yeah. So much stuff going on.
So a lot of anniversaries, but let's start with the 75th. What do we know about what the symphony looked like back in the day?
Well, originally it was a group of local amateurs put together. They played in hotels. And gradually over the years, things became more professionalized as more musicians were hired, as it became a full-time job, as they hired music directors from other cities. And during my time at the symphony, we've grown enormously. You know, we used to be 52 musicians full-time, now we're 60. Our budget has grown by over $4 million in the last 10 years. And I think our relevance to the community has also increased a lot. You know, we've diversified a lot of our offerings in terms of the kind of concerts that we present, but also in the kind of people that we try to represent on stage, so that we can attract more people to our audience.
No more playing in hotels.
No more playing in hotels.
Yeah. And this is also your 10th anniversary, which it seems like time flies.
It really has. It's gone so quickly. I can't believe it. Yeah, I moved to Jacksonville 8 years ago and I've done the job for 10. So next year is my 10th official year, but it's actually my 11th because I had a year as music director designate before that. So it's been a wonderful decade. I mean, the orchestra has just gone from strength to strength.
And so how have you decided to celebrate these dueling anniversaries?
Well, we've gone all out with programming. It's our most ambitious season so far. We open on September 21st with a special performance of Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection. That features really starry soloists, Eileen Perez, the soprano, and Isabel Leonard, the mezzo. The joint choruses of the Jacksonville Symphony, Jacksonville University, and the University of North Florida, plus the Jacksonville Symphony Chorus. So a massive group of singers. Mm. And then the whole season, we've just upped the ante in every way in the programming. So the opening couple of weeks contain Mahler 2 on special, Richard Strauss's Heldenleben, Edward Elgar's Enigma Variations, all on classical concerts. We have three commissions next season from Conrad Tau, Carlos Simon. We have an artist in residence. We have great guest conductors, Bob Spano and Isaac Stern. The list goes on and on.
And so we're going to listen to some Mahler in a bit when we get back. I'm going to have you kind of walk us through some of what we're listening for and what people can expect to hear when they attend. But just briefly, if people are looking for something, you know, on the schedule that the symphony has coming up, is that just something that they find on the website? Or is there a newsletter? Do you guys do any kind of distribution?
We do. If you go to jacksymphony.org, you can sign up for our newsletter, which tells you everything that's going on. But also, if you go to the website, you can download a PDF of the season brochure. Beautifully rebranded this season. We have a new logo, new typeface. Everything's brand new. It looks beautiful. And that lists every performance that we have in specials, classical, films and music, pops. And they can see the entire listing right there.
Okay, beautiful. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk more about what's on deck.
Great. Thank you.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Classical 24 brings listeners beautiful music from around the world, featuring the best of classical music from the all-time greats to the newest composers and performances. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. For decades, federal surveys have tracked the health of new mothers, but rarely a partner's well-being.
The mom started to write in the margins of the survey, "Why is the only question you ask me about my partner was did my partner hit, kick, beat, or slap me during pregnancy?"
A new program monitors the health of new dads. Next time, here and now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
One way to defeat traffic gridlock? Get on a bike. Cities like Paris and Amsterdam are well known for being bicycle friendly, and so is Mexico City, though it's following its own path.
It's like, look at Amsterdam, let's do it in Mexico City. I'm like, no, Mexico City looks different. We have to find our own way to do it.
I'm Marco Werman. How North America's largest city became bikeable. That's tomorrow on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Migraine. It's one of the most common diseases in the world, affecting more than 1 billion people. It's not just a bad headache. It can interfere with daily activities, and three times as many women experience migraine than men. As part of our series, In Good Health, we're discussing women and migraine. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, I'm joined, as I was, by music director and conductor of the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra, Courtney Lewis. We are talking about the upcoming 75th anniversary season of the symphony, his own 10-year anniversary. Well, we've said it's actually a little longer than that.
It's 10 officially.
You had a 11. Red shirt year, so yeah. We're okay. So how do you choose the season lineup? Is that something that's entirely up to you as music director?
The classical concerts are very much for me to think about. I work with the team, with our artistic administrator and VP, Tony Nicol. There are lots of things to consider. We want to have a range of repertoire. We want to have particular guest artists. We know some people are available. We know some people aren't. There are budget considerations. Every program I put together is run through a logarithm by a PR company to see how well it might sell. So yes, the original ideas are often mine, but they go through lots of different groups of people. Tony and Tori, our head of marketing, work on pops programs and movies. So it's a big group effort to put the whole thing together. And it happens years in advance. Next year is completely done. The year after, it's nearly finished. The year after that, we're already thinking about.
Wow.
Because classical artists book years ahead. And there are so many pieces to come together to make a concert happen.
Oh, that's extraordinary. Yeah. I had no idea that it required that level of advanced planning. For the pops and the kind of more pop culture-y elements that the symphony offers. How important are those to kind of fostering a relationship with the community? And I mean, I would guess that your love and your priority is sort of the classical side, but you make room for all of these other productions.
Well, we do equal numbers of pops and classical shows. Some people prefer the pops. It doesn't really tend to cross over the audience between the two. You know, you don't get somebody coming in for a pop show and then they trickle over to classical. It tends to be quite discreet. But it's wonderful when you go to one of the movies and the hall is always sold out. And, you know, it's, for example, I went to Harry Potter a couple of years ago and we have two Harry Potters, Deathly Hallows Parts 1 and 2 in concert this coming season. You know, people show up wearing the houses of Harry Potter, you know, the clothes, and kids with their families. There's a real electric atmosphere of excitement. And then, of course, hearing the orchestra play the score, you kind of forget that the orchestra's there when you're watching it. And then all of a sudden you hear this music and there's no speaker. It's right there in front of you live. It's very exciting.
So for people who haven't been there, you're watching the film with the dialogue and then an orchestral piece or a music piece comes up. And so the orchestra is playing along with the film.
Exactly. Yep.
In perfect time.
Yes. And it's hard to do. The conductor has a really tough job. I used to do it when I was an assistant conductor, and I'm glad that I've been able to pass it off to my assistants here. You have all sorts of streaming banners in front of you on a screen when you're conducting that you have to line up. It takes a little bit of practice.
Wow, that's extraordinary. So what are you said that there's going to be two Harry Potters. What other film offerings are on deck this year?
So we've got the two Harry Potters, as I mentioned. We also have some Star Wars, A New Hope in concert. And I think that's it, just those three.
Okay. So one of the performances, I think maybe one of the early ones, is Mahler's Symphony No. 2. Mm-hmm. You said that's the Resurrection Symphony.
Correct, yeah.
So I would want to listen to a little bit of that. Can you set it up for us? Let us know what we should be listening for.
So the story of Mahler 2 is that a great person, a hero, is having a kind of struggle in life. And it's a very Beethovenian idea of darkness to light, that the first movement is stormy, the second movement is a kind of Dream of the Past. It contains two songs with the mezzo and soprano singing. And then in the end, it's a piece about death being something that can be overcome and the soul is resurrected at the end in a very secular, non-religious way. Rise again, my soul, you will rise again. And it's one of the most thrilling, optimistic ends to any symphony.
Now let's hear a little bit of it. So this is now like 150-year-old.
1899.
Okay. Yeah. But it was very popular at the time, very successful.
It was one of Mahler's most successful symphonies in his own lifetime. He played it a lot himself. He was a great conductor. He was the greatest conductor of the day, the head of the Vienna State Opera. And he was also a great missionary for his own music and conducted a lot all around the world. And of course, also, he was music director of the New York Philharmonic at the end of his life. And he performed it with them as well a lot.
And so are you aiming to be a faithful interpreter? Are you trying to bring a new, you know, kind of light or sound to it when you're conducting?
Well, I mean, as a conductor, yeah, you do interpret a piece, but I'm always trying to get as close to what I think the composer's intentions were. So you have the score, and Mahler's score is often like a roadmap. There's so much information written in, so much extra information. But you also read about him. You try to understand his life, where he was coming from, and be as faithful to the score as you want. You know, a conductor shouldn't really be trying to stamp his or her own personality on a piece. I think that's a little disingenuous. You do anyway. You can't help it. You can't help but be yourself. But the guiding principle has got to be getting as close to the composer's intentions as possible.
So big things coming up this season. I know that there's going to be a lot of celebration, and I'm sure we'll have you back to talk more as we get into the season. But I hope you have a great break.
Thank you.
And folks can go to the Symphony website if they want to get tickets or look at the season.
That's right, jacksymphony.org. Please go there for tickets, nowhere else. You buy your tickets there, you'll get the best seats.
All right, Courtney Lewis, thanks so much for being here. Great to see you.
My pleasure, Anne. Lovely to see you too.
And that's our program. If you join us tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the state of rental housing and living conditions in Jacksonville with a focus on multifamily properties. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.